4 weeks ago today, on the afternoon of May the 2nd, I attended one of the more uplifting events I think I've been in on for some time, and several members of our congregation here were present as well. It took place over in the town hall in Milford. It was a celebration of what's called the Harriet Wilson Project. Harriet Wilson, as has now been amply demonstrated, was the first African-American writer and African-American woman in America to have a book published. It happened in 1853. Mrs. Wilson was a resident of Milford, New Hampshire, and her novel is a fictionalized version of her treatment as a servant for a well-to-do mid-19th century Milford family. Technically, Harriet Wilson was a free black woman, but her overall circumstances with respect to the family she worked for amounted to virtual slavery. She did, however, gain a level of literacy and learning that led her to write a book she titled Our Pig, the title being a satirical take on the way she was referred to in the household where she worked. Her book had very limited circulation in and around the Boston area when it first came out, but then, some years ago, a few copies surfaced again. And if you just go by the text alone, you cannot tell who Harriet Wilson really was or where she lived or what the family was that she was writing about. But her identity, her residency in Milford in the mid-1800s, and her overall outline of her life have been recovered due in large measure to the work of Dr. Henry Louis Gates. Dr. Gates is the chairperson of the Department of African and African American Studies at Harvard University. And he was in Milford on May the 2nd to help celebrate the re-release of this book, including a new introduction to it, which he has written. He was the principal speaker there as part of a larger event of music, drama, and just generally celebrating the life of this heretofore obscure African-American woman from Milford. And as those who were there will attest, and I see some of you who were there today who were over there, it was a really wonderful, a very celebratory occasion. One of the several things that I came away from that event greatly impressed with was Dr. Gates's recounting in the course of his remarks the impact his family had on him during his growing up days in the small rural West Virginia town of Piedmont, an upbringing which he chronicles in one of the several books he's published. The book is called Colored People. I know I seem to be on a kick lately about talking about people from small West Virginia towns. If you just bear with me, I will get through this and get over it in due time. I can tell you, it is a long way, in ways more than geographical, from Piedmont, West Virginia to Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was enough of a challenge if you were a white person in the mid-1950s looking to make such a journey of that nature and such a journey of ambition. You can double that challenge at least if you were black in one of those little towns. Well, the most moving part that I found of Dr. Gates' presentation in Milford, though, was his recounting of some of the motivation and some of the impetus that he received for making his own journey. As was the case with me, it was largely by way of books. But for Dr. Gates, it was more than that. And a week after this event, much to my surprise, I opened up the op-ed page of the Sunday New York Times. There's an article by Dr. Gates, which was basically recounting some of the same things he had said in Milford a week or so earlier. He recalls that initially he wanted to be a doctor, but his love of literature sent him in another direction. He did indeed become Dr. Gates, but with a literary rather than a medical doctor. I'd like to read a little from his Times article, which, as I just said, contains some of what he had said in Milford a week earlier. Books were magic carpets, transporting me through time and space. But it was not these worlds of fantasy, brought into our two-bedroom cottage in the Allegheny Mountains, that diverted me from what seemed to be my destiny. I realize now it was, of all things, my mother's example. No one would have thought of her as our family's principal storyteller. That role my father occupied, famously. If he was our bard, our local storyteller, it was my mother, who was our writer, our biographer, and colored Piedmont's very own CBS scribe. For my mother had the task of writing the obituaries that appeared in our town's weekly newspapers when its black citizens died. And it was she who read the expanded version of his eulogies at funerals held in one of Piedmont's three black congregations. I've always felt a twinge of remorse, but I never became the doctor my mother hoped I'd be. But if I drifted from that path, it was because of her and the music of her words. In his talk at Milford, Henry Gates added that on his way home from those Piedmont funerals where his mother had read her eulogy, her father would rib his mother a little. Gates' father would rib his wife a little by asking just who it was she was talking about back there at the church, since he couldn't quite recall some of the more illustrious qualities that she was ascribing to the deceased. As Dr. Gates explained, that was his father's way of telling his wife she'd done a good job. Well, I was planning to use this story, this account, about 3 weeks ago on Mother's Day as a way of opening up into the wider topic of Families for Everyone. As those of you who were here on that Sunday will recall, that sermon ended up taking on a life and direction of its own, which wound up as an op-ed piece in our local paper here. But I promised back on that Sunday that I would return to my originally intended topic for that day. I try to be a man of my word as best I can, so you are getting it today. Well, I offer Dr. Gates' story for several reasons, but because it's a very uplifting story to hear. I had a chance to talk with him a few minutes before, a little bit before the meeting began, when he was signing some books and told him about my own West Virginia origins. So I now have a couple of Dr. Gates' books inscribed from one West Virginia homeboy to another that he wrote for me there. So it was a good day. But I offer that story also because I think it points to what families, at their best, can and do offer. The support, the love, the companionship that he witnessed between his parents. Families, in part, are what happens between two loving persons. And the launching pad, so to speak, that his family offered for him to eventually find his own way in the world. That is a role that can and is fulfilled by both two-parent as well as single-parent families. And we also know, some of us from direct personal experience, others of us second and third hand, that not all families operate in such a positive manner all the time. In fact, the grand paradox of families was stated quite well, I feel, by the journalist Barbara Ehrenreich in one of her Time magazine essays from several years ago, which she titled, "Oh, Those Family Values." Here's what she said. Theoretically, and oftentimes actually, the family nurtures warm, loving feelings, uncontaminated by greed, power, or hunger. Within the family, and often only within the family, individuals are loved for themselves, whether they are infirm, incontinent, infantile, or eccentric. At best, the family teaches the finest things human beings can learn from one another: generosity and love. But it can also be where we learn nasty things like rage and hate and shame. Americans act out their ambivalence about the family without ever owning up to it. Millions adhere to creeds that are militantly pro-family. But at the same time, millions of others flock to therapy groups that offer to heal the inner child from damage inflicted by family life. Well, a more humorous angle I found on Ms. Ehrenreich's commentary was in a more recent New Yorker cartoon showing a young college student writing a letter home. The letter said, "Dear Mom and Dad, thanks for giving me such a wonderful childhood. You ruined any chance I ever had of being a famous writer." Well, Ehrenreich, after her, is simply pointing out what a mixed bag a phenomenon like family really is. And the very wide variety of images, memories, and emotions that just the term alone can evoke. I know for some of you, many of you, your most cherished thoughts and feelings, as do mine, derive from your family of origin and the family of which you are a part today. I know that for others, the term may well evoke memories and feelings that are not near as positive, or that recall unresolved conflicts and tensions from both the past and ones that still may exist today. I would guess that many of us experience some mix of the many and varied variables that a term like family calls forth. So there are a couple of things that I want to do with this topic of families for everyone. For I've used that phrase in two somewhat related ways. First, I mean that everyone has some kind of family relationship and connections that shape our lives, in whatever shape or shapes they come to take. And we need to understand that, and we need to come to terms with it. And second, we are now seeing yet another understanding of family come into our society and culture, with just the beginning of marriages, legal marriages, for same-sex couples, and families with same-sex parents. I'll try to touch on both of those for the next few minutes. As to that first point, there's no escaping the reality of family. That sounds pretty self-evident. But I do recall a stretch of time in the early 60s where at least some alleged experts on family theory were claiming that the traditional family structure had somehow outlived its usefulness and we were going to evolve into some more radical kinds of structures and shapes. I remember a book by a psychiatrist named David Cooper called The Death of the Family, which was typical of this genre. Well, yes, the family certainly has changed over time. If we go back, and I mean way back, centuries, millennia, we find that the primary cause of families were there for basically social and economic reasons. They were there to provide kind of a basic societal and economic unit for bringing children into the world and then socializing them and teaching them a trade so they could go on perpetuating that system. Within the overall span of human history, if you take that whole thing into account, having a family begin by two people falling in love and getting married and then maybe beginning a family of their own is a relatively recent thing. It's a good thing, to be sure, but it's not a timeless phenomenon. And then we know that in the past 30 to 40 years, the family has evolved quite a bit more than it didn't die or become radically rearranged, as Cooper and others like him were predicting. And so while today only 15 to 20%, depending upon whose figures you use, of American families are what we would call the traditional ones, the father at work, mother at home with the kids, the families with which I am familiar are not radically different, I would think, from the ones in which I grew up. I know the role of family members have significantly changed, and they sure do seem a heck of a lot busier now than they ever were. When I was growing up, I, much as I wouldn't want to read some of my family of origins economic situations, I still think that the fact that we only had one car, which my father had to use to go to work Monday through Friday and sometimes on Saturdays as well, meant that my mother wasn't driving me and my three sisters around to God knows what kinds of social engagements, athletic practice, or anything else. We all kind of had to stay home or stay in our neighborhood and make do with what we had there because there wasn't any other place we could go beyond where our bicycles might take us. So as I say, they significantly changed. They seem a lot busier, but that hardly constitutes a radical revolution. I think as long as there are human beings, there will be families for everyone and forever. But I find that what has changed is that when now I reflect on what constitutes a family, I find myself thinking more in terms of what it is we want a family to do and what we need of it and expect of it, more so than how it's actually constituted or who actually makes it up. And in doing so, I think back to some words that have become very familiar to me now, the words I use in child dedication and naming ceremonies, both the ones I do in the context of a worship service here and more private ceremonies in families' homes or other places. And the words that I use, they're specific to that situation about the child, but they have much wider implications than that. Here are the lines I have in mind. Each human life is bound with others, and this is especially true within the family. It is here that each person is shaped and formed by all the interactions of thought, affection, of act, and word. In the relationships of family, we receive our sense of what is right and wrong, our sense of worth and personhood, our feeling of who we are and what our unique place in the world is. Now, as I say, I usually say those words with a couple standing next to me holding a child and with close and with members of the family and friends right there in attendance. And those words always seem to work. They seem to strike some deep and resonant chord every time I say them. However familiar they may be to me, they still have a real fresh meaning to the people who are hearing them, particularly in the presence of a recently born child. And yet I'm aware as well, excuse me, as I reflect on them a little more closely, that these words could also speak to a religious community. They could speak to a close, intimate circle of people in relationship with one another. They could speak to any number of ways of people being with each other. And I know for some that a religious community or that close circle of acquaintances becomes the family when it takes on those roles that those words describe and point to. I'm also aware that when I look at what I'm actually saying with these words, that I'm asking a heck of a lot. I'm a very human and fragile institution, like a family. To shape and form a person. To offer a sense of worth and personhood. To offer knowledge of right and wrong. To be a place where people find their own unique selves. That's what we expect of families, however constituted. In addition to providing for the material, more material and functional needs of life. And I just stated, it's not only children towards whom such expectations are directed, even for adults, the family remains the basic unit to which we look for acceptance, support, personal affirmation, respect, and trust. We know the family is also the most human of human institutions. Meaning that it is directly subject to some of the best and, unfortunately at times, some of the worst of human beings, and all else in between. Some of us have come from family settings where we can primarily feel gratitude that these kind of needs and expectations were, to a large degree, fulfilled. Those were the kind of sentiments that Dr. Gates was talking about in his presentation over in Milford. I know that others of us are looking for ways to come to terms with the fact that their families did not meet all those needs and expectations. They may be looking for ways to forgive those who were either unable or unwilling, for whatever reason, to be about the meeting of those needs. In a book called Traits of a Healthy Family, the author, Peter Collier, observes, your family is what you've got. It is your limits and your possibilities. Sometimes you'll get so far away from it, you'll think you're outside its influence forever. Then before you figure out what's happening, it will be right beside you, pulling the strings. Some people will get crushed by their families. Others are saved by them. Crushed, saved, or some of both. Mr. Collier makes a wise observation in noting that your family of origin is something you can never completely walk away from. And this brings us to what I consider to be the greatest irony in terms of what is needed and expected of one's family of origin. One's family of origin, however constituted, however weak or strong, functional or dysfunctional, crushing or saving, is the institution, the social unit, against which or in the face of we define ourselves and take responsibility for ourselves. In this respect, families are indeed for everyone. Well, second point of just two, please hope. In recent months, we have seen strides taken towards, as well as great resistance to, extending the definition of family in legal, as well as societal and cultural terms to same-sex couples, and in some cases, families with same-sex parents. We already know that there are same-sex couples and families, some within our welcoming congregation here, that are and have for some time been fulfilling those roles and expectations and needs of family, to which I've already spoken this morning. And now the move is on to bring the same legal benefits, sanctions, and responsibilities that already apply to those families with or without children made up of heterosexual couples. Now, I know that in a setting like this when I am mostly, if not entirely, preaching to the choir, you even on a Sunday the choir has off. But I'd still like to offer just a few thoughts on the matter. Since I've been officiating same-sex services of union for close to 20 years now, there's really no other position I could or would want to take other than to advocate that these unions receive the benefits and be given the responsibilities of legal civil marriage in addition to the spiritual benefits that I am able to offer. In fact, I believe that the burden of proof on this whole matter is on those who would deny such a right and responsibility to a same-sex couple to show how the extension of such a right would in any way harm the existing institutes of civil marriage or the larger society in general. And I've yet to hear that case cogently, rationally, or reasonably made. I will say that I do not believe that any clergy member of any faith or any faith community of any kind should have to recognize, from their religious perspective, a marriage which they feel they cannot sanction. But as a civil matter and right, I find no civil grounds for denying the legal rights and benefits of marriage to any couple who wish to enter into it, regardless of their sexual orientation. So I was delighted with the decision that is effect by the Massachusetts Supreme Court, brought forth by two Unitarian Universalist women, as a matter of fact. And I am proud of the role that my many Unitarian Universalist ministerial colleagues in that state are playing in officiating now legal same-sex marriages in that state. How this admittedly volatile matter will continue to play out in that state and across the country is yet to be seen. And it brings in more dimensions and raises more issues and concerns than I can undertake right now. We clearly have not heard the end of it, so stay tuned. I would like to believe that Mike Varner, news commentator, columnist, and sports guy that I really like, was correct in a piece he had in the Boston Herald last week when he said that a year from now we may be wondering what all the fuss was about. Well, Mike, I just hope you're right. I read the Herald, as well as the book. I discovered that the Herald, even though its editorial page doesn't always jive with my own thoughts too much, actually has the better sports writers. So that's why I pick it up once in a while. And Cal Thomas, in the Herald, weighed in on this issue several days ago in a way that actually kind of knocked me off my socks. Thomas is a former spokesperson for the Morrow Majority. He's now become a regular talking head for the Fox TV News Network's fair and balanced coverage of current events. He's also a syndicated columnist. And in last Saturday's, a week ago yesterday, Saturday's Herald, Mr. Thomas weighed in on the same-sex marriage issue. Well, his first 8 or 9 paragraphs were a pretty predictable rant about how this move was the latest indicator of the declining fall of all that's right, decent, and moral about Western civilization. But when he got the last paragraph, it was like he just suddenly ran out of gas or something. Anyway, he becomes lucid. He comes to his senses, and he writes this. Pro-family groups have given it their best shot, but this debate is over. They would do well to spend their energy and resources building up their side of the cultural divide and demonstrating how their own precepts are supposed to work. Divorce remains a great threat to family stability, and there are far more heterosexuals divorcing and cohabiting than there are homosexuals wishing to marry. If religious conservatives wish to influence culture, they will redirect their attention to repairing their own cracked foundation. Indeed. But indeed is mine, not his. But then his last line is, an improved heterosexual family structure will do more for the greater good than attempts to halt the inevitable. Gee, Cal, I couldn't have said it better myself. And it's amazing how sane and articulate a columnist like Mr. Thomas becomes when I find myself in agreement with it. Inevitable or not, this is an issue, as I say, that will be with us for some time. It will continue to call for our attention, I'm sure. I don't think it's time to close for today. The phrase and title that I've used for today, Families for Everyone, is really a part of my ongoing vision, my ongoing hope for this congregation, that we be a place, a loving, accepting, and welcoming place for a variety of families. Those with children, those without, those with two parents, those with one. As I've noticed how the issue of childbearing has come into the same-sex marriage debate, I'm aware that in this congregation, we have some heterosexual couples who either by choice or circumstance have no children. We have some same-sex couples who are in the process of raising their children. They're all families. And this is their spiritual home and gathering place. And for those who may be bereft of family right now, those who may be feeling their family ties diminished, or those who are still healing from some of the wounds of family that Ms. Ehrenreich refers to, my hope is that within this congregation, they will find the care, the compassion, the affirmation, and the support that any healthy family provides. And that's a task that we share together in common to make that happen. You want a family for everyone? Right here and right now, in this place we call home. I think the song that best states that hope is the one I have chosen for our closing hymn. It's the first song in our hymnal, number 1. Let's sing that together.